Let's open our Bibles to Genesis chapter 39. You know, if anybody had a right to complain about their life, it was Joseph. You guys know the story of Joseph pretty well, at least many of you do. It's interesting because we live in a world where, and we used to have a saying, I think I've shared it before, but we lived in Southern Cal, in a rather upscale neighborhood, Newport Beach. And there was a, we weren't upscale, we were there for comic relief, I need to tell you that, but we had a mock prayer. Pray for me, my Porsche won't start. We live in a culture here in the United States where the idea of difficulties is a little bit different. You know, if our latte is cold, we live in a fairly pampered society, you know? You look into average or even good life 4,000 years ago, that's when Joseph lived, we would consider the best of the lives that they lived to be a very deprived existence. We would consider that. When you think about what happened to Joseph, how he was treated by those closest to him, by his radically dysfunctional, yet another dysfunctional family in the patriarchal line, and you look at his life, he had every reason in the world to complain about things that had gone wrong in his life. Every reason in the world. And the wonderful thing about Joseph is you don't hear any complaining. You hear a request now and then that he might be remembered, and we're gonna look at one of those this evening. But he's an awesome man, and I think it's interesting that so much of the book of Genesis is devoted to Joseph, considering he's not the oldest of Jacob's sons. Now, to bring you up to speed, in case you're here this evening for the first time or the first time in a while, the book of Genesis is about God's redemption, as indeed the entire Bible is. The book of Genesis almost skips over creation, the thing we're so interested in, and rushes past the flood, gets past the early judgments, all the way to talk about Abraham, because Abraham is the beginning of a family that will bless humanity with the Messiah. And from Genesis 12 to the end of the book, the rest of the 50 chapters, it's all about Abraham's family. And now we've gotten to the fourth generation as we look into chapter 39. We've gotten into the fourth generation of that family. And that generation is the generation of the 12 patriarchs, the sons of Jacob, who was the son of Isaac, who was the son of Abraham. So the 12 patriarchs are, as we begin the story this evening, the 12 patriarchs are in their 20s to 30s, and Joseph is the second to the youngest. He is 17. And if you'll remember what happened, the year is approximately 1889 BC. Okay? 1889 BC, roughly 4,000 years ago. And if you'll remember what happened, Joseph had been the favorite of his father, Jacob. And Jacob made him a coat that made his brothers jealous. And Joseph sort of rubbed it in. And his brothers said, "Here comes the tattletale," basically, one day. And they were far enough away from Dad, some 50-plus miles away from Dad's home base, out on a sort of a field trip with the animals. And they said, "Let's just get rid of this kid right now." And against his strenuous objections and his weeping, really, and his begging for mercy, they threw him in a deep pit, a cistern in all probability, and they left him there. They debated whether to kill him or not. His oldest brother, Reuben, said, "Nah, let's not kill him." Reuben intended to come back and rescue him. But while Reuben was away, they sold Joseph to slavers who were on their way to Egypt, which is quite a bit south from where these men were. Ishmaelites they were. They were in a camel train of some sort, and they came by, and Joseph's brothers said, "We have a slave in this hole. We'll sell him to you." We don't know how much they got for him. But they split it up, and they sold Joseph into slavery. Now, I want you to consider the trauma of this. We're so familiar with the story that we forget the traumas. Whenever you read the accounts anywhere in the Bible, you must read in the trauma that occurs in a human soul when something like this happens. Joseph has lost everything that makes him who he is, with the exception of just a couple of things, which we'll talk about as we go through. Take, for example, the fact that he lost all of his security. his entire sense of who he was, his whole identity, and his culture, his security, his identity, and his culture completely taken away. And we can sit here with ours all intact, and we can say, well, you know, his faith should have been strong, and so on and so forth. The fact of the matter is, if you lose any one of these three, my friend, it will put you through a mega change in who you are. You lose any one of these three things, the deep sense of security for where you're gonna, what you're going to live on, what you're going to eat tomorrow and in the weeks and the months and the years to come, any shaking up of your sense of security, and you will be frightened to death. You lose your culture. You go cross-cultural for a little while. It's fun to visit. But after a while, when you're in another country where you don't know the language and you don't know the customs and you're always stepping on your tongue and you're always doing something wrong in that other culture, you get real tired of it. And if you have to stay there a long period of time and you have to learn a whole new culture and you are the alien, if you've never done it, if you've never been an alien somewhere else, then you don't know how disrupting that is to the human soul. And that's what happens to him. Not only is he an alien, he's a slave. What about his identity? You know, he was his dad's favorite guy. I mean, he had that coat. You can imagine him getting to Egypt and saying, you know, I used to have a coat that was really cool. That was his whole identity in those days, and it was gone. Imagine your identity being completely gone. It's not a bad exercise. Take all the things that make you who you are. Every once in a while, through the years, I sit down and I ask myself who I would be if I were not the pastor of the Trail Christian Fellowship. And it's weird because I've been here for so long, some 20 years. It's an odd feeling to ask myself that. And then I ask a deeper one, what would I be if I were not a father? What would I be if I were not now a grandfather? I'm just getting used to that one. I don't want to give that up. What would I be if I were not a husband? What if I could turn, what if the clock got turned back and I lost all that God has given me in the last 26 years? 26 years ago, I was none of the above. What would happen? Who would I be? What would your identity be if you didn't have your career, if you didn't have your marriage? Who would you really be on the inside? Well, if you've ever had to find that out, Even a little bit, you know it's traumatizing. It's traumatizing to even examine it too deeply. Imagine having it all taken away, his entire identity taken away, stripped. He is now an alien. He is a slave. He went from the favored status in a large, wealthy family with a huge promise and great potential to nothing. Nothing left but his faith. I would hope that I would be able to say, I think I'm able to say it, I would still be a man of God. I hope I would be able to say that. I don't want to have to find that out. I don't want to have to find out by having everything taken away. But I would hope that I would say I'm still a man of God. Well, all of this happened to Joseph at the age of 17. At the age of 17, he was literally thrown into a foreign world. A pagan world, the Egyptian world, where they looked different. I don't know if you know how different the Egyptians looked than the Hebrews. We tend to think everybody in the ancient days looked the same. They didn't. The Hebrews had long beards. They were scruffy looking. They were from the north. And the Egyptians were clean shaven, smooth. Their facial features, their bodies, everything was different about the Egyptians. The Egyptians were really very, very beautiful people, both the men and the women. They had very fine features. And they had a very wealthy and urbane society. And this young man is being thrown into an urban society, you might say. In fact, very much so. By comparison to where he came from, the agricultural world of Canaan, being thrown into this, by their standards, high-tech urban society at the age of 17, and a society that worshipped all kinds of different gods, all kinds of different animals. You know, it would be the sovereign hand of God that would just preserve a young man's faith under those kind of circumstances. And that's exactly what happens. That's exactly what happens to this fellow. Incidentally, if you're one of the guys going to the men's retreat this weekend, we're going to be talking about another young man, very similar situation, and what God does in his life too. Every once in a while, it's good for us to sit back and say to ourselves, look at what God has done in my life. Look at the size of my life. What would it be like if it all got reduced? Would my faith still be intact? It's a good question. Joseph's faith was, and we'll see how it works. Joseph had been a bit spoiled, as I mentioned before, and he was a bit arrogant. He sort of had, he was managing, producing a movie starring himself, and he had his brothers sort of playing bit parts. God had told him he would have a position of authority someday, and he had the incredible lack of wisdom to tell his older brothers about this. You just don't tell your older brothers about that. It's kind of what made them all mad. And the reason I say that is that in chapter 39, God begins a training program for young Joseph that for the next 13 years takes what is really good character but had grown a little arrogant and tempers that character and hones the personality that we see in this man. It starts in chapter 39 with being sold to an Egyptian officer by the name of Potiphar. Verse 1 of chapter 39 of Genesis. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. And the Lord was with Joseph. So he became prosperous, I think the NIV renders it, successful. The Hebrew word simply means that he moved forward. He was able to do well under the circumstances. It doesn't mean that he was not a slave anymore. The hand of the Lord was with him, and he became successful as a slave. Does that not sound like an oxymoron to you? God says, I'm going to make you successful. Yes, Lord, here am I. Send me as a slave. Here am I, Lord. Send him. And he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Now his master saw that the Lord was with him and how the Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and became his personal servant. And he made him overseer over his house and over all that he owned. And over all that he owned, he put him in charge. And it came about that from the time he made him overseer in his house and over all that he owned, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house on account of Joseph. Thus the Lord's blessing was upon all that he owned in the house and in the field. So he left everything he owned in Joseph's care. And with him there, he did not concern himself with anything except the food which he ate. Now Joseph was handsome in form and in appearance. Let's go back and have a look at the situation. Potiphar, the chief of the bodyguard, is probably the chief executioner, by the way. And you might say chief of the secret police. He's a very, very high official in Pharaoh's court. And to work for this man, of course, we know that God's hand was on Joseph, putting him in a position where he would be heard by Pharaoh and come to know Pharaoh sooner or later. But early on, of course, Joseph never knew any of that until after the fact. But Potiphar was an extremely important man, and it was a good placement. It just was a wonderful happenstance that the Ishmaelites happened to be selling Joseph at the time that Potiphar was buying, and God was arranging it. Potiphar was an extremely powerful man. Joseph had several assets, four to be precise. First of all, he had a relationship with God, which is the greatest asset anyone ever has. And he's the only one in his entire circle. There was no one else for him to fellowship with. There was no one else to teach him anything. He simply had a personal relationship with God that was sustained on its own. And it's an amazing thing because some people have such a strong relationship with the Lord that they can actually continue to walk with him over extended periods of time in very lonely circumstances. And that's exactly what happens in Joseph's life. First, he had a relationship with God. Secondly, he was gifted for secular work. In other words, he was gifted as an administrator, and we find he rises to the top wherever God puts him. Some people think that being gifted for secular work couldn't possibly be God's will, but that's not true. God gifts people in secular work all the time, and he uses them. You know, there's a lot of times when people think, well, if I'm real spiritual, I'll be a full-time missionary, or I'll be a full-time pastor, or I'll be a full-time something where I get to be, you know, I get to be a professional Christian. I mean, that's, you know, I don't want to be an amateur, Christian. I want to be a professional Christian. And that must be the height of spirituality. Well, that's actually not true. Matter of fact, the height of spirituality is simply living with Jesus Christ as your Lord and then blooming wherever you are planted. And he actually was not a priest. He was not a prophet in that sense. He was not what we would call a professional Christian. And if you find yourself in a situation where you're thinking, I am less than spiritual, because actually, here I am, I do a good job at what I do, and you know what? I like it. I hate to admit it because it's not official, you know, professional ministry, but I really like what I do, and God's given me this gift. Well, then God probably has you right where he wants you, and if he wants you to move, he'll tell you. It's perfectly good to have gifts that set you apart in secular work, and God will use you right where you are. And that's what he does with Joseph. You count through in the Bible how many people God uses that we think of as professional Christians who had actually secular positions and secular gifts, you might say, gifts in the secular world. Go through so many of the prophets, so many of the men whose words we read, David, Solomon, Daniel. I mean, these men were administrators in major kingdoms. They had secular jobs. And we're going to find, of course, that Joseph becomes one of those. But early on, he shows a great knack for administration, basically, which doesn't sound very glorious, does it? You know, you say, well, I do administration. Well, that doesn't sound very spiritual. Well, it is spiritual depending on how you do it and who you do it for. If you're doing it for the Lord and you're serving the Lord in the capacity that you find yourself, it's extremely spiritual. And that's exactly the way Joseph is. He was actually a born administrator. That's why his father trusted him. His father put him in charge. That's why he got in so much trouble. He was younger than his brothers, who were kind of not born administrators. They were born goof-offs, actually, several of them. And he was a born administrator. And we think to ourselves, well, not very spiritual, but that's not true. Third, he had very high personal integrity, so high that when Joseph was on the scene, Potiphar didn't worry about anything that was under Joseph's care. You know, that is so wonderful. Are you the kind of person, by the way, who when you're on the scene, whoever might be above you, whoever might be, in a sense, overseeing your work, has nothing to worry about? You know how they think, and you want to do the very best you can for them, and you want them never to have to worry about the details that they have given over to you. You know, that is an incredible gift. If you've got the ability to have that kind of integrity, so that wherever you work, whoever you serve, and we all serve somebody. Some of us serve boards, and some of us serve organizations, and some of us serve individuals. But if you've got the ability that an administrator over you says to themselves, man, if she's in charge of that, I am not in the least worried about it. I know she's not going to steal anything. I know she's not going to lie to me. I know that if something goes wrong, she'll tell me the whole story. I know that she'll do her absolute level best to make it work. I absolutely trust her. Or him. Are you that kind of a person? I hope so, because it's a great witness. And you want to know something? There aren't very many people like that. You ask any employer, any business owner, any supervisor, there are not many people of whom you can say, if that person's on the scene, I'm not going to worry about anything. Just wake me when it's over, you know? And that's really, it's a wonderful, wonderful gift, and it's a wonderful, wonderful witness for Jesus Christ. If you're that kind of a worker, I guarantee you, you're a good witness to your supervisor. That's the way Joseph was. And finally, he was good looking. I had to put that in there because it really is an asset. And it got him in some trouble. It's the fourth of his great assets. But the first three really are the ones that he could do something about. The fourth one, he couldn't do anything about that. If you're good looking, you're good looking, and if you're not, you're not. And we all wish we were, and we all wish we were more so, but that's just the way it is. You know, the Lord uses him, this good looking, young man of integrity with good gifts, even though he's a slave. And it says that God's hand was on him and God's hand was with him. You know, you would think if you're going to say, God's hand is on me or God's hand is with me, if you came to Joseph while he was in the cistern, or while he was on the camel, you know, where they strapped him down on the top of a camel. I don't want to ride a camel even not strapped down. Can you imagine being strapped down on the hump of a camel all the way to Egypt? And he's thinking to himself, if the Lord is with me, I wish he'd leave me alone. Don't you think? Well, if it's so wonderful to belong to you, Lord, then how come this is happening to me? Do you feel like you're strapped over a camel right now? Maybe. And maybe you can remember a time when you felt like that. And people were saying, oh, but it's good to know God. And you're going, oh, yeah. You know, the camel's moving. And you're going, oh, yeah, I love loving God. It says that the Lord was with him and he prospered him. But you know what? You could look at it another way if you were Joseph. In almost every situation we find ourselves, you can look at it one of two ways, can't you? You can either look at it by saying, look at the good things God has done and is doing. And we just looked at the assets that Joseph had. But if Joseph were a kind of a glass half empty kind of guy, he might be able to say, yeah, and I lost my family and I lost my inheritance and now I'm a slave. People look down on me and they order me around. I used to be the one to order people around. You see, a lot of how we deal with things depends on how we evaluate them and whether we see them from God's perspective or whether we see them from the underneath side, from our perspective. And it's not just looking on the bright side, it's actually looking on the providential side. It's actually saying, wait a minute, it's not just count your many blessings, because that sometimes sounds too trite. It's more than that. It's a theological position. It's a theological decision that because I walk with God, I will look at the good that God has done. I will look at the good that God has done, and I will focus on that because I believe it's good. And I will assume that the bad that I have experienced is part of the good that God is accomplishing in the long run. And that, if that just rolled through your head and you're going, yeah, 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 then you're not thinking about it, or you haven't had very hard times. But it's true. A lot of how we deal with things depends on how we look at it. If Joseph had been a faithless man, he could have looked at this in an entirely different way. So, well, he's good looking and that gets him in trouble. Beginning in verse 7, his assets actually put him in position to be tempted in some very specific ways. Because he is talented, because he is good looking, because he rises in the organization of Potiphar's household, which apparently was sizable, there were several servants, several different people, because he becomes the chief of staff, highly visible, he comes under the scrutiny of Mrs. Potiphar, who is a floozy. There is no Hebrew word for floozy that I'm aware of, so I just put the English word on there. She is a floozy. And she, you know the story, she just tries to drag him into bed. That's what she tries to do. It's interesting because the term for officer is the term eunuch, actually. And it says that he's one of Pharaoh's officers. It's possible that Potiphar was a eunuch and that his wife was in the habit of fooling around. That's entirely possible. We're not sure because the term is sometimes used of people that were not eunuchs, and it was the term for a royal official. But in the ancient cultures, most of the royal officials were eunuchs because they had to be around the harem all the time. And the kings and the pharaohs had large, beautiful harems. Many beautiful women were in the court. And they wanted to be able to trust the men. And so very often, the men were eunuchs. They made them eunuchs in order to become chief officers. If that's the case, then the chances are that she was in the habit, perhaps, of propositioning anybody she wanted to through the years. But she does this with Joseph. It came about, verse 7, after these events, that his master's wife looked with desire at Joseph, and she said, lie with me. No, really, what's really on your mind? I mean, it's like, you wonder, how long did this take? What was going on? Probably several years. It was 13 years between the time Joseph was sold into slavery and the time he became Pharaoh's right-hand man, 13 years. We know that at least 3 to 4 of those were spent in jail, which we'll get to in just a minute. And so we may be talking 7, 8, 9 years that he was with, or 10 years that he was with this household. It wasn't a meteoric rise to power, probably took a little while. Long enough for her to get to know him and long enough for her to say to herself, I like that young man. And for her to start flirting with him. And she did consistently flirt with him, as we find out. And she finally makes it very clear what her intentions are. Verse 8, but he refused, and he said to his master's wife, behold, with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house, and he's put all that he owns in my charge. And there's no one greater in this house than I am, and he has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. Now then, how then could I do this great evil and sin against God? And it came about as she spoke to Joseph day after day. And isn't that the way with temptation? The problem is not the one-time temptation. The problem is the consistent water dripping on the rock kind of temptation. And sexuality tends to be that way in our culture, especially for men. It is a perpetual thing, and our culture just pounds on men constantly. It's part of our advertising. It's very lucrative business. And now with the internet, it's a multi-billion-dollar business. It already was a billion-dollar business. And it's day after day after day. And that's what happens with Joseph. It came about that as she spoke to Joseph day after day, it's like every day she would come and she would let on that she wanted to sleep with him. He did not listen to her, to lie beside her, or to be with her. Now it happened one day that he went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the household was there inside. And she caught him by his garment and said, lie with me. Can you imagine maybe some of you guys actually have imagined that sort of thing. And that's the problem, isn't it? Isn't it? I mean, you know, you take a young guy like this, and he's thinking to himself, Lord, bring me a woman. And up comes a woman, and she says, lie with me now. And he's thinking to himself, not this one. A very different approach than most men in most of human history. That's because he's a unique man. She grabs his clothing. He left his garment in her hand, and he ran away, ran outside, went streaking. Actually, he wasn't naked. It was his outer cloak. And he's a little rough on his clothes, too. Did you notice that? I mean, he keeps losing cloaks. So she grabs this one, and he runs out. And when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and had fled outside, she called to the men of her household, and she said, see, he has brought, meaning her husband, he's brought in a Hebrew to us to make sport of us. That's interesting because she's sort of blaming Potiphar. Do you notice this? Do you pick up a little bit of the anger that she has against her husband? And for whatever reason, that anger is there, and it set this thing partly in motion. She's laying this at the feet of Potiphar. He brought this Hebrew, never forget you're an alien here, to us to make sport of us. He came in to me to lie with me, and I screamed. Now, she's going to turn the whole thing and blame it on him because he wouldn't have anything to do with her. And she's really ticked. Hell hath no fury, right? And it came about when he heard that I raised my voice and screamed, that he left his garment beside me and fled and went outside. And she left his garment beside her until his master came home. She kept that there as evidence to blame him. And she spoke to him with these words, the Hebrew slave whom you brought to us came in to me to make sport of me. And it happened as I raised my voice and screamed that he left his garment beside me and he fled outside. What a horrible situation. And yet, you know what? Joseph wins, and we know he wins. He actually gets the victory in this situation, even though it looks for all the world like a failure. Because what Potiphar does, it says that, verse 19, it came about when his master heard these words from his wife, what she spoke to him, saying, this is what your slave did, that his anger burned, and Joseph's master took him and put him in the jail, in the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in the jail. We'll stop there for just a minute. I want to point out how Joseph actually won. You might be thinking, he won? Is this another one of those blessings like riding the camel, like from the cistern to the... Actually, in a way, it sort of is. What happens is that the Lord is still with him, and the Lord blesses him in the jail, and there again, it's another oxymoron. You're thinking to yourself, oh boy, more blessings, Lord. I can hardly wait. I'm now in jail. Thank you for all these blessings of belonging to you. And yet, looking back on it, knowing the whole story, which he did not know at the time, we know he won. And by the way, very often that is the case. You may feel like you're losing and you're hanging on by the skin of your teeth in a situation where you only can trust God and he's the only one you can trust, and you feel like you're all alone and you're running away in your skivvies from whatever it is, and you think, you feel like, am I winning? But you know what? Integrity is an achievement. It's not something you give up in order to achieve. Integrity is an achievement. It's not something you sacrifice in order to achieve. And that's why we know Joseph was winning here. Well, how is it that he was able to say no to this woman? Because honest and truly, you take a young guy like this under these kind of circumstances, knowing he would not get caught, she might blackmail him. But he would probably, in all probability, he would not get caught for doing this. Young, single guy in a foreign country where he doesn't know anybody and nobody knows him. Nobody from his old Sunday school class is going to show up, you know. And how did he do this? Let me suggest some things. And I know I'm probably speaking mostly to men, but maybe to women too. How did he keep his cool in a situation like this? How did he win? Well, first of all, he viewed this as a betrayal of trust against her husband. Do you notice that in verse 8? We would be viewing this as something that, you know, you could make a pretty good case for kind of caving in to her temptation. She's been nice to him up to this point. He doesn't want to make her mad, you know? We'll get to that a little more in a moment. He can kind of keep the peace, get more done, and so on and so forth. And he doesn't view it as anything that is good for him. He views sexual immorality as a violation of someone else. And interestingly, it's not primarily her, it's her husband that's being violated in the situation. And that's what he says in verse 8. He says, with me here, my master doesn't concern himself with anything in the house. He's put everything under my charge. There's no one greater here than I am. He's withheld nothing from me except you. See, what he's saying is, I can't do this because I have someone else that I'm serving, even though as a red-blooded young man, he probably wanted to very badly. And yet he saw who else was going to get hurt. And you know something? Sexual immorality doesn't just hurt you, it hurts the people around you. It actually defrauds others that you don't think about when the temptation arises. It hurts other people that you don't think about when the temptation arises. So the first thing Joseph thought about, and I encourage you to think about it when the temptation arises too. First thing Joseph thought about was, who else is this going to hurt? Is it going to hurt somebody that trusts me? And it always does. It always does. Secondly, he viewed it as a sin against God. And this is the real kicker in verse 9. You would think, did you read verse 9? Did anybody notice? There's no one greater in this house than I. He has withheld nothing from me except you because you're his wife. How then could I do this great evil? And you know, the rest of that sentence should read, how could I do this great evil against Potiphar? But that's not how it reads. Even though we know he cared about his charge that Potiphar had given to him. Actually, the real anchor in his soul is this right here. How could I do this great evil against God? The sin is a sin against God. All sin is. And you should cross-reference Psalm 51, verse 4. Against you and you only have I sinned. That's what David said after Bathsheba. I've sinned against you, Lord. You're the main one I've sinned against. Joseph actually viewed the Lord as looking over his shoulder. And you know, that's a good thing to remember when sexual immorality raises its head and says, come this way. Any kind of sexual immorality. Remember, God is watching. It's amazing how the integrity is much better when you know somebody's watching. But if the person's invisible, it's sometimes sort of easy to forget that they're watching. And the Lord says, don't forget, I am watching. Joseph was keenly aware of that. And it's interesting, too, that he considered it a great sin, a great, great evil. It's not considered a great evil in our world. In fact, it's considered sort of normal. Sexual temptation is normal. Sexual immorality is a great sin. The deed of sexual immorality is a great sin. And our culture is in deep trouble because it doesn't view it as a great sin. So he viewed it as a huge offense against God. Third, He viewed it as his responsibility to resist and not hers. Do you notice there's an interesting line? How could I do this great evil against God? He did not say, how could you do this great evil against God? Or how could you do this great evil against me? Or how could you do this great evil against your husband? He said, how could I do this great evil? Let me point something out. How you deal with your sexuality is your responsibility. It is your responsibility. It's nobody else's. And I say this to men all the time, because we live in a world that just throws sexual temptation in men's faces constantly, every single day. And guys will say to themselves, well, it really wasn't my fault. I mean, I'm only human. And you know, you can only take so much temptation. But the fact of the matter is, you make the decision. And I want us to realize something. If we're going to be victorious in this area, men and women, you are responsible for what you do. You can't stop the temptation, but you are responsible for your actions. And that Joseph understood, and I believe it was that knowledge that helped him to make the right decision. And every person I've known who has gained victory in this area, part of the victory was understanding that they had the ability to say no, and that they had to take responsibility for their decisions. Because as long as they were hiding behind, well, I just can't take it anymore, then it'd be open season on them. Joseph really saw this as his responsibility, and something I tell men all the time when I counsel with them or when I teach at men's retreats on the subject and so on, is that no matter what a woman does, no matter what the advertising system is, a man is responsible for his actions every single time, all the time. God holds men and women responsible no matter what anybody else does. There's an unwritten rule in our culture. It's a terrible thing, but there has been for generations an unwritten rule that a man or a boy should be able to get away with anything he can get away with, and it was up to the girl to say no to him. And the Bible says the exact opposite. It's up to the man to say no. He says no first. He is the responsible party, and he is to blame if no is not said when it should be said. I don't care if she tears her clothes off and throws herself on you. That's what I tell guys. I don't care. You have a responsibility. Well, that's exactly the Joseph story right there. And he took that responsibility. It's a good thing to remember. And then finally, he let the chips fall. He made his decision. And no matter what happened, his career was on the line. And furthermore, and this is kind of a tricky thing, she wouldn't like him anymore. Now that's, you say, well, what does that matter? You know, when you're in a relationship that has a tendency or has a propensity to get sexual, you do care what the other person thinks. And there is a kind of a weird kind of codependency that draws you in. And you got to not care about hurting someone else's feelings if that someone else is tempting you sexually. But it's very tough for polite people to do that, especially people who sort of like each other anyway and have kind of gotten to be friends. And you can just imagine how that friendship sort of developed there in Potiphar's household. And at first, he was kind of flattered and pleased that she liked him, and then gradually he began to realize, she's bumping into me when she doesn't need to bump into me. And she's wearing less clothing than she needs to be wearing when I'm in the room. And slowly but surely, there's this tension that starts to build up. And he has to say, am I going to make it so that she doesn't like me anymore? Because she really seems to like me. And I want to be liked. I mean, maybe I don't want to fall into sin, but I really want to be liked. I don't want people to not like me. Let me give you a piece of advice. You got to let the chips fall if you're going to avoid sexual immorality. You got to not care if someone else likes you or not, and this is for both men and women, because you can be manipulated into doing something you know is wrong for no other reason than just because you don't want the other person to be upset with you. And Joseph didn't care. He left the cloak there. It threatened his career. He probably figured she was going to say something about him, but he didn't care. He's figuring, I don't care what I lose. I will not do this. And you know, it takes that kind of nerve and that kind of guts to win in this battle. It takes that, I don't care what I lose. I will not let go of this. You've got to do that. You've got to live that way if you're going to win, especially in our world. I guarantee it, in our world. And it's not getting better. It is getting worse. So, just some reminders. I know I sound like a preacher. Well, I am. I am a preacher. He viewed it as a betrayal of trust against her husband. He viewed it as a sin against God, a serious and terrible sin. He viewed it as his responsibility to resist her, not her responsibility to resist him. He took real responsibility in it. And he let the chips fall. He was not codependent. He actually said, I don't care if you like me or not. I'm out of here. It takes a lot of nerve to do that. It takes a strong walk with God. And you can't be a people pleaser if you're going to win. Well, she lied about him. Potiphar said, oh, you didn't. And he threw him in jail. Now, the interesting thing is, he threw him in his own jail. Did you know that? Did you know that Potiphar was in charge of the jail that he put him in? It was kind of the white-collar jail. Really, seriously. And something else you need to know, because we find that out in chapter 40, but something else you need to know is that the penalty for adultery was death in Egypt. And in fact, in most of the ancient cultures, the penalty for adultery was death. Can you imagine? I mean, the population explosion in our country would be greatly reduced if we enforced that law. And you know, the idea of making adultery illegal would be considered insane in America. It used to be, of course. It used to be terribly illegal. Can you imagine what would happen if anybody running for any office, I don't care what, a dog catcher, who had part of his platform, I think adultery ought to be illegal and really punishable by law. Can you imagine what would happen in this culture? In the ancient cultures, even in the pagan cultures, which tells you about our culture, doesn't it? Even in the pagan cultures, it was considered an offense worthy of capital punishment. Now, Potiphar was the chief of the bodyguard of Pharaoh, which meant he was in charge of executions. He was in charge of the prison where all of the prisoners of the king, the personal prisoners of the king, kind of like the really important prisoners, went. But this was Potiphar's jail. And that's where he puts Joseph. He does not execute him. He puts him in this, it wasn't a cushy jail, don't get me wrong, but he could have killed him and he didn't. And instead he puts him in this jail, verse 21, and it says, but the Lord was with Joseph and extended kindness to him and gave him favor in the sight of the chief jailer. And the chief jailer committed to Joseph's charge all the prisoners who were in the jail. I don't know if this is a promotion or a demotion, but everywhere he goes, he gets to be in charge of something. He says, you know, I was in charge of my brothers, and then I got sold into slavery. Then I was in charge of the household of the guy that bought me, and then I got put in jail. Now I'm in charge of the jail. I think my career's kind of going the wrong way, but wherever I go, I get to be in charge of something. by the way, if you have skill and integrity, you'll probably rise in whatever work you do. Wherever you are, might be a little pond, might be a mud hole, but you'll be at the top of it. Wherever God puts you, if you have integrity and you have skill, you're going to rise wherever you are. And that's the way it was with him. And he had no control over his career track at all. None. But there he went. And the Lord used him in the jail. Now, how do you suppose? Well, look at verse 23. He was responsible for everything. Verse 22, the chief jailer did not supervise anything under Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made to prosper. Does this ring a bell? Now, wait a minute. This is exactly what happened with Potiphar. Let's put two and two and two and two and two and two together and see what might have happened. Why did Potiphar not have him executed? Why did Potiphar put him in his own jail? How did the jailer know that Joseph was going to be a good administrator? Maybe Potiphar told him he was a good administrator. Why would Potiphar tell him he's a good administrator? Why would Potiphar put him in there in the first place instead of killing him? I don't think Potiphar trusted Mrs. Potiphar. That's my personal opinion. I think he probably figured, there she goes again. But here he is, he's stuck. You say, well, why doesn't he just tell his wife to take a hike? You know, in those days, most of the marriages were arranged between important families. Now, what would an important guy, who may have been a eunuch anyway, have to gain by alienating his wife over her affairs and alienating her family and maybe an important part of the government and so on? And so I think what happened was she told him all this, and he said, oh, my, how terrible. I'll just throw him right in jail. Will that be okay? Well, yes. And he puts him in jail, truly, and it was not a good jail. It was a bad jail, but it was not as bad as it could have been. And he doesn't get executed. And he actually rises to the top down there, and he gets to still serve Potiphar. He's actually still doing Potiphar. He's just in the lower part of the organization. I think Potiphar didn't trust his wife. Well, the Lord had a plan anyway. Chapter 40, it came about after these things that the cupbearer and the baker for the king of Egypt offended their lord, the king of Egypt. These guys were in charge of all the food. Cupbearer was in charge of all the wine. That meant the vineyards, too. These were very big-time executives. They ran a lot of stuff. The baker was in charge of all of the cooking, not just the bread. But he was in charge of a lot of stuff, and they did something that offended the king. And I'm sure it wasn't just the taste of the food. It was probably, since they were in charge of food, and this eventually is a capital offense, that apparently some palace intrigue must have been uncovered, which may have involved poisoning the pharaoh. I mean, more than one king in those days died of poisoning. And that's why cupbearers were there, by the way. Technically, they were there to eat the food, and if the guy died, then the pharaoh didn't eat it. It was like that little parakeet that they carry, you know, down in the mines. You know, the parakeet dies, you don't breathe the air. And so being the cupbearer to the king was kind of an honor, but kind of an odd honor, actually, you know. And so the cupbearer had charge of the food because he had to eat it before the king did. And so if there was poison in it, the cupbearer would die. So that was the way the king made sure that the food was good. That was a way to do it. So chances are it was a kind of a plot going on, and Pharaoh found out about it. He was furious with his two officials, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker. And he put him in confinement in the house of the captain of the bodyguard. Well, that's Potiphar, captain of the bodyguard. And so that's how we know this is Potiphar's jail. And in the same place where Joseph was imprisoned. And the captain of the bodyguard put Joseph in charge of all of them, and he took care of them, and they were in confinement for some time. And the cupbearer and the baker for the king of Egypt, who were confined in the jail, they both had a dream on the same night, and each man with his own dream, and each dream with his own interpretation. Joseph came to them, verse 6, in the morning, and observed them, and he said, hey, you guys look like you had a bad night. And he asked Pharaoh's officials, who were in confinement there, he said, why is your face so sad today? And they said, well, we had a dream, and there's no one to interpret it. And Joseph said, oh, I've had dreams. I understand a little bit about dreams, and it's true. And he knew how to interpret them. And he said, God knows how to do this. Why don't you tell me about it? Which is very interesting. He knew he represented God. Do you notice what he says here? God knows how to do this. Tell me about it. And they knew that he represented God. It's an interesting thing. He had a witness. One way or another, he had sort of a witness to these people. God knows what about this. Tell me about it. And so they do. And the cupbearer told his dream to Joseph. He said, hey, look, this was the dream. There was a vine in front of me, and on the vine were three branches. And as it was budding, its blossoms came out, and the clusters produced ripe grapes. And the Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes and squeezed them into the Pharaoh's cup, and I put the cup to the Pharaoh's hand. That was the dream. Joseph said, ah, this is the interpretation. The three branches are 3 days. In three more days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your office, and you'll be putting Pharaoh's cup back in his hand according to your former custom when you were his cupbearer. Only keep me in mind. Now, Joseph has interpretation. He says, now, when that happens, would you please remember me? Here's my card. Keep me in mind when it goes well with you, and please do me this kindness by mentioning me to Pharaoh, and get me out of this place. This is a pit here, literally. For I was, in fact, kidnapped from the land of the Hebrews. He never forgot this. It's been many years. He still hasn't forgotten his original identity. I was kidnapped from the land of the Hebrews, and even there I hadn't done anything that they should have put me into this dungeon. He was not in denial about who was wrong and who was right in all of this, but you notice there's sort of an absence of bitterness here. He's just not licking his wounds, but he's taken an opportunity. I mean, he's taken an opportunity for some advancement here, put in a good word for me, because I don't really deserve to be in this prison. Well, the baker said, that is great news. I love that. Listen to my dream. And so he tells him his dream. Here's my dream. There were three baskets of white bread. He's thinking, yeah, 3 days. Three baskets of white bread on my head. And on the top basket, there were all sorts of baked goods for the Pharaoh. And the birds were eating them out of the basket on my head. And Joseph said, you know, your dream's not as good as the other guy's dream. This is its interpretation. The three baskets are 3 days. Yes, yes. Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head. Yes, yes, from you. Oh. And will hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat the flesh off of you. Oh, bummer. Well, what happened was, apparently, during the period, they got to know each other a little bit, enough that these guys came in dejected, right? And he noticed that they were dejected, which means over a period of time, he'd gotten to know them in the jail. That means there must have been some sort of an investigation going on. And apparently, the investigation was completed, and it was the baker who turned out to be the guilty party. It's not important for us to understand how and what all went on in that intrigue. What is important for us to understand is that God gave Joseph the ability to understand what was going on here. This becomes very important later in chapter 41, which we won't get to this evening. But that's why the account is here. Joseph's skill is what's being brought out. Verse 20. It came about on the third day, which was Pharaoh's birthday. He made a feast for all his servants, and he lifted up the head of the chief cupbearer and the head of the chief baker among his servants, and he restored the chief cupbearer to his office, and he put the cup into Pharaoh's hand, and he hanged the chief baker, just as Joseph had interpreted to them. And the chief cupbearer, verse 23, look at this. Yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph. He forgot him. We're going to stop there. And the reason I'm stopping there is not because it's the end of the story, but because, you know, when you're in a situation where you feel like you've been forgotten, it feels like the end of the story. And I'm really glad that there's a chapter ending there, even though the chapter endings are not really inspired. But I think it's a good place to stop for a good reason. Because, you know, sometimes when life doesn't seem to be working and you feel like I've been forgotten, forgotten by people or forgotten by God or forgotten by both, and you begin to wonder, I want to offer some advice about that, because Joseph, as we'll see in his account and the rest of the book, is blessed in some odd ways. He has some really, really difficult times, and yet God has a plan in all of them. I want to offer just three pieces of advice that I think we see in what Joseph's doing here, and that'll help us get through, because life doesn't always go right, quote unquote. And by right, I mean the way we planned it. But there's some things we can do, not to fix it, but to get through it. And that's what you want to do, my Christian friend. When life is not going right, it's not a matter of fixing it. It's not a matter of just getting God to fix it. It's getting through it. It's getting through the trial. It's getting through the test. It's passing the test. That's all you need to worry about, and it's only one day at a time. So just a little advice. The first is this. Think more about God than you do about people. When you're in this kind, when life is not going right, the tendency is to think more about people than you do about God, and to get angrier and angrier and angrier about them. Because people fail all the time, and they fail us all the time. And we are surrounded by them. And the thing about Joseph is, it doesn't show up all the time, but when it does, it shows he's been thinking about God a lot. These moments, I mean, a guy who, when he's being tempted by this woman who's coming up, and she's probably attractive, and she's literally throwing herself at a young guy, and he says, I won't sin against God. I guarantee you, he didn't just start thinking about God that moment. He had a habit pattern of thinking about God. He'd been thinking about God every day for a long time. And about how to walk with God, and about how to please God. And that's the only way to deal with temptation, is to have been thinking about God for a long time. If you hadn't been thinking about your relationship with the Lord prior to the onset of the test, the chances of you suddenly remembering your discipleship at a moment like that are very slim. The thing we need to do, you guys, is think more about the Lord and less about people. Think more about how glorious He is and less about how dumb people are. And more about how smart God is, and less about how evil all the people around us are. More about how sovereign and providential God is, and less about how goofed up people's plans are, and how many people have completely failed us. You know, a lot of us spend a lot of time, I'll talk more about this in a minute too, because it's part of one of the other points, but a lot of us spend a lot of time thinking about people.
especially bad people, people who've hurt us. And we don't spend nearly as much time thinking about the Lord and who he is and what he's doing and really pouring ourselves into learning more about him and understanding him and being impressed with him. People are small compared to God. J.I. Packer once pointed out that in our culture, we have great thoughts of man and small thoughts of God. And if we're going to live healthy lives, especially when life isn't going right, and there are big stretches of life that don't go right, we got to have big thoughts of God and small thoughts of man. And sometimes we just have to say about humanity, big deal. Sometimes we need to look at the TV and everything it says is important, and we need to say to ourselves, big deal. My God is bigger than the election. Wake me when it's over. I have bigger fish to fry. I have more important things to think about. Well, what more important things to think about than the new king of the world? Well, God, the real king of the world. You mean you just want to meditate on theology? You just want to think about how great God is? Yes, because I find when I think about how great God is, it brings great peace to my soul. And I'm so glad I belong to him. Big thoughts about God, small thoughts about humanity, and that will help you get through when life isn't working, when really life is not working. Joseph was that way, and everybody in the Bible who survived was that way too. Just they were absolutely impressed with God. Here's the second thing. Focus more on opportunity than on justice. Now, that's a tricky one. Here's what happens when we are mistreated. We want justice. This is unfair. This is unfair. I should not have been sold into slavery. I did nothing to deserve any of this treatment that I'm getting right now. I have bent over backwards to be the person I ought to be. It's unfair. I want justice. I want absolute justice. I'm mad at God because he didn't give me what I deserve because I've been so good. I'm mad at people because I stood up and they wouldn't stand up. And I did my part and they didn't do their part. And I'm mad at them and I told them what to do. They did the opposite and then I got in trouble from my supervisor. And I'm mad at them. I want justice. And you know, it's interesting because Joseph could have done a lot of that and he doesn't do any of it. Instead, you know what he did? Instead of looking for justice, he looked for opportunity. Very interesting way to view life. Instead of saying, I have to have justice in order to feel good, he said, I'm looking for opportunity so I can do good. And everywhere he went, he did something good. Everywhere he went, even though people mistreated him and everything went wrong and life wasn't right, wherever he found himself, he did something good. And he considered himself to be walking with God. And he served the Lord to the best of his capacity in that light. Don't look for justice. Look for opportunity. Because injustice is going to happen and you're going to be mistreated and lousy things occur. But you know what? In all of them, there are opportunities. Opportunities to serve. Opportunities to be used in your gifts. Use them. It's a way to get through. It doesn't solve the injustice. It doesn't make it all feel better all the time. But it's a way to get through. That's all we're talking about. Surviving the test. Look for opportunities instead of justice. And here's the last one. Be more absorbed with the quality of your character than the timing of your career. The quality of your character than the timing of your career. Joseph, we know what he had coming. He did not know that. And it's a good thing we don't know what God has in store for all of us. But sometimes we look at our watch and we go, come on, Lord, it's getting late. And I have certain things that I have on my agenda that have to get done. And we will oftentimes scratch a little of the character in order to get the thing done we think needs to get done. And you know what? God doesn't even wear a watch. Isn't that odd? Doesn't even wear a watch. And you know why? It's because he's more concerned with what's going on in character than he is with the timing of our career, what we think our career is going to be. He has a timing. And it's more than just perfect timing. It's the fact that he's working on the inside. See? Doing something on the inside. And I believe Joseph was concerned with the quality of his character and the quality of his contribution wherever he was, much more so than with the timing. Even though he said, remember me to Pharaoh. He took the opportunity. If he had it, he was going to get out of there. But he still paid attention to what God was doing on the inside. Think more about God than about people. Focus more on the opportunity than on the need for justice. Be more absorbed with the quality of your character than with the timing of your career. Joseph had no control over his life, we would consider ourselves terribly depraved. Deprived. Depraved, too. That's not a bad word, actually. We'd be terribly deprived if we were as lacking in personal sovereignty as Joseph was. He had no control over anything significant in his life. And he'd been mistreated and thrown aside and all this stuff, except he did have control over this, his faith, his moral integrity, and his work ethic. He had that. And you know what? That's why we consider him to this very day to be a winner, a man who served God. Let's bow our heads. Father, thank you. Thank you for giving to us the account of a man whose life really was fraught with problems early on, and who spent years in what we know to be training, but he might have thought it was punishment. Lord, teach us how to work with you, to serve you, when life itself around us isn't working. We trust you. In Jesus' name, amen.